to House Talk on News Radio Wham 1180. The show is a weekly conversation about all things you should know when buying, selling, or maintaining your home. Join in with your comments or questions. Call or text 222-1180 or 1-800-295-1180. Now, live from the News Radio Wham 1180 studios in downtown Rochester, here are your hosts, Jeff Schofield, Mike Reed, and Jamie Messner.
Welcome back to House Talk at Wham 1180. This is Jeff Schofield with RE/MAX Plus.
Mike Reed with All County Inspection Services.
Jamie Messner, Premium Mortgage.
And the real estate beat goes on. Things are, they always slow down a little bit this time of the year, but you know, what I like is if we have buyers, they are definitely looking for a home. You know, everybody else, it was just casually have kind of put it on the back burner now. Good time to sell. I mean, it really is. Go ahead.
I just had a client get an offer accepted with concessions. So it's a good time.
Well, you know, I had a home that was on the market, initially overpriced, but we just got an offer accepted on that. The overpricing, you want to test the price. Don't do the delayed negotiations. It just doesn't work out well. Interestingly enough, I got to give you credit. I ran in last night. I had a banquet that I went to where they honored John Antetomaso out of our office. He had a school that he had listed in a shut down school. They had discontinued. I guess it said empty for 6 years, and he sold it to a microbrewery. But it was, I ran into a lot of people that I haven't seen in years. You know, some of them, you know, I guess listened to the show. One guy was definitely a fan. And I ran into a mortgage broker that I had used years ago. And this is just, you know, I'm not going to mention names, and hopefully he's not one of them that listened, but I remember him calling, you know, saying, well, you know, try me. And somebody else, a mutual friend, had said, you know, give him a try. And I was meeting with a client. Now, if you go back, you know, the whole pre-approval really, you know, became front and center in the last 5 to 10 years. But, you know, you go back to a while back and you have somebody pre-qualified. Well, I had an open house Sunday afternoon. They wanted to buy it. I said, all right, I'll meet you at your house afterwards. I went to their house to write up an offer. And I go, okay, what kind of mortgage? Well, we don't know. So I called this guy and I get an answer, little kid answering the phone. Hello? And I'm like, my clients are sitting there listening, you know, to me talk to the little kid. And finally, I go, is your daddy there? And he gives the phone to his dad, you know, and dad's like, oh, he loves to answer the phone. And I'm thinking, you're professional. If your kid loves a phone, buy him his own. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I'm not calling like you guys. Well, you know, Mike, I talk to once in a while on the show, you know, and you guys, but I'm not calling up going, hey, what do you think about those bills? If I'm calling somebody in your business, it's business related. So kudos to you. I mean, I don't think I've ever called where you haven't answered your phone. You know, you've got the same philosophy, you know, that everybody that's going to try to make a living in this business should have.
Well, and it's gotten, especially now in this, you know, work from home era. I hate it when I call somebody business related and I hear the dog barking in the background, kids music in the background. I did it the other day with an insurance, my insurance company. I called them to ask some questions about something. And the person was completely distracted. I'm trying to talk to somebody about something that's important that I pay for. And I could completely tell that they weren't even there. They were working from home. I could hear dogs, TV in the background, kids. And I'm like, I respect it. But at some point, we got to go back to doing business here. Like, I spend thousands of dollars a year with you guys on this product. I would like you to pay attention to me. At least hear my questions.
Yeah. Or create the dog in other room. Well,
get an office from home. Shut your door. Work from home. Working from the kitchen counter talking to people. Just, it didn't seem to work, especially in that scenario. Sounds like yours the same way. Kids answering the phone, business phone call.
I mean, I kind of understand the working from home thing. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's been proven that it's quite effective. You know, a lot of people can get a lot of work done. We can get more workforce because somebody that has the ability, but they have to be at home taking care of a kid or something, you know, they can still work. But I guess if you're, you know, interfacing with the public, you know, then you ought to have a quiet workspace.
Yeah, I think for very, very specific jobs, it probably works very well. But other jobs, you know, being a real estate agent probably doesn't work from working from home.
I can't work from home just because ADD kicks in.
Yeah, I would prefer not to. I have the ability to. I would definitely all day prefer to go to the office. Way more productive there. And I'm one of those people that has been guilty of their dog barking in the background or things going on. And it's just way more easy to focus when you don't have those distractions, let alone having the other person on the other end of the phone hear them as well. So
yeah, we went and rented offices for that very reason. Mm-hmm. I caught myself, you know, taking notes with an orange crayon one day while I'm talking to a lady on the phone because my kids had raided my desk. And, you know, this was pre-pandemic. And I'm like, this just isn't effective. I'm, you know, and I also, then I know I wind up, you know, doing the laundry and walking the dog.
Yeah, that's it for me.
I just get on, I get unproductive.
Cleaning the garage and, you know, sorting out stuff. Different topic. I got a call from a gentleman. He goes, do you sell mini homes? And I'm like, well, I haven't. I mean, I've had some homes that were really small, but not, you know, by the classification of mini homes. And he has a mini home that they constructed out of a shipping container. And I showed you guys, well, I didn't show you many pictures, but it was pretty cool. And I had kind of thought, well, I don't know how they do it. You'd almost have to put them on a slab. And Mike used to have a lot that he was going to sell. And I guess, you know, you said you already sold it, but do you guys know of anybody locally that actually has a mini home? It's like probably 120 square feet.
We looked at a mini home that was what we were told was a mini home. We got there and it was just a glorified trailer. It was, you know, they jacked it up. It was a trailer they jacked up, put on blocks, and then built around the frame of the trailer. So other than that, no, I don't know of any legitimate mini homes. They're shipping containers, garden sheds. And we run into questions with them as, you know, are they meeting code requirements? Because they're not being built with traditional, you know, traditional construction techniques and methods. So how is that shipping container that's been modified considered a home? And can you borrow money against them? Where is that?
He asked me if I could sell it for him. And I thought, you know, no, I can't. I mean, for me to sell real estate, you know, it has to have land associated with it. Or, you know, but again, we sell mobile homes too, though. So I guess, you know, I don't know. I'd have to look into that more. I always was told we had to have land.
Yeah, I would think a mobile home probably has a whole different type of mortgage. Or are they the same type of mortgage?
No, they're lenders. They're specified.
Yeah, they do. There are different.
Different lenders. Credit unions a lot of time will
especially
do
if they're not on their own land. Because a lot of times they're leased through a development or a park or something. So that's a totally different ball game.
Yeah, and there's a difference between modular homes, mobile homes, and, you know, and trailers. Mm-hmm.
So. And I guess what I found out is you can't get a mortgage on a mobile home that's older than 1972.
Mm-hmm. And it's got to, has to be a double wide, older, newer than 1972, have all of the, mobile things removed, like the wheels, all of those things removed, be on its own land.
Yeah.
Be on a permanent foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know there's requirements on foundational tie downs, foundational requirements. And, you know, we looked at actually becoming, you know, certified to do that, working with an engineered company. And there just didn't seem much demand for it around here. There didn't seem, you know, customers weren't looking for it.
You know, it's kind of interesting with the housing shortage. You know, you would think that that'd be something that more developers would be looking into, although I know that there's a lot of communities that probably don't want mobile home parks added to their, well, I don't even think they have a tax roll for mobile homes, do they? Well, I guess we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Welcome back to House Talk on WHAM 1180 News Radio.
I've mentioned this before. We've had conversations about house flippers. And I got a call this past week. Somebody had bought a house with the intent of flipping it. They're currently listed at $189.9. It didn't sell. Didn't sell. I said, well, you know, you're listed with a good agent. It didn't sell. It's price. You know, it's a price issue. And they go, well, we've got a problem then because we're down to not making any money. And I will tell you that, you know, I read statistics. I was looking at some NAR reports. The statistics, house flippers, they're actually the profit went up a little bit this year as opposed to last year. Across the country, this year, people have been profiting $56,000. Mike, you've done house flips. I mean, when I used to do them, my goal was $10,000 to $15,000 profit. Now, it could be because I went for less expensive homes.
Yeah, I want to find out where those people are at because I want to go flip houses there. I just don't see $50,000. I mean, I know guys that made 30 and they're ecstatic. Like I made 30 off of that house, but it was a 6-month project.
Yeah.
You made 30 grand. And I think part of it will have to do with how you structure your company. So I bet there are some people that are drawing a salary off of that and then other people are not drawing a salary. So they say they made profit, but they really didn't because they drew salary out of themselves. I think people are fudging numbers when they start throwing 50, 60 grand out on a house.
I have a friend of mine who does a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, he's got a company that just does house flipping. And I remember years ago, he told me he made money on about half of them. Now, clearly, if you follow this guy, he makes enough money from the other half that offset it. But God forbid you're one of those people that buy one of them that he lost his, you know, derriere on because you don't have 40 other homes to compensate for it.
Right. Yeah. And maybe that's part of it, too, is you're looking at, you know, there are national flipping companies.
Well, that's
and they may be doing an average. Mm-hmm. They may look at it and go, you know, we flipped across the nation 250 homes and our average was 50,000 because half of them lost 20 grand and the other half made 70 grand. You know, that I bet they're doing something like that.
Well, I had a friend of mine that was addicted to, you know, flip this house on HGTV. And I will tell you, the market's different here. I mean, it really is. There's a lot of differences between us and the national. You know, we don't have the variance that other people do.
Right.
You know, like you look on HGTV and, you know, they're saying, well, you know, we can buy this house for 200 and, you know, we put 100 into it and then we sold it for 450.
Yeah. And that may be it. Cause I mean, I'll use a house that, you know, I had, you know, we have renters in it right now. We are looking to just see what the market would do to get rid of it. And the numbers were okay, but there wasn't that kind of profit, you know, going to have to hold it another year and keep tenants in it another year to make it worth selling. You know, we bought it for 120, put 40 in it and we're only going to get maybe 190 out of it. Pay commissions, pay closing costs, you didn't make any money.
Yeah.
So the money that's going to come in will be the rent. So, and it's a nice house and a nice neighborhood. It's in good shape. It just maybe come spring, the market will bounce back to where it's a little bit better. But, you know, there's really not that profit there.
Have you ever bought a house on the courthouse steps?
No.
Foreclosure?
No.
Now, there's a different, you know, you're buying a house where it's highly likely the owners are still in the house. Mm-hmm. So you've got to make a decision based on a drive-by, you know, based on possibly from when they bought it. You know, you might have a real estate agent that can pull it up from when they bought it and find out, was it a disaster when they bought it? And they probably haven't fixed it up. But there's a lot of caution thrown to the wind when you buy one that sight unseen.
Well, yeah, and you don't have a clue what's going on. I mean, even if the place is vacant and you haven't been able to get into it, I mean, there are structural issues, mold issues, electrical, plumbing. You have to really just make the assumption I'm doing everything. Yeah. And anything that I get to keep is gravy. And we also do a lot of inspections on flips. There are a lot of flips that have been done poorly. They have beautiful tile floor that you walk across it and you hear the tile break up, the mortar break up as you're walking through there. It's beautiful tile. It's going to come up in a year. Or the structural issues that were there were just drywalled over, and in 6 weeks, you got structural issues again. So, you know, there's the people that may be making money by not doing it properly. So I think if you're buying a flip, you really have to do your due diligence.
Well, and try to determine who did it.
Exactly.
Was it somebody that does it a lot? Did they actually have contractors? Or was it, you know, mom and pop that were working there after they got home from – you know, the office, and it was a hobby for him.
Right.
Because I know some of the work I had done in the past. You know, I was once told by an inspector, you ought to just stick to selling real estate and not do work. And he's absolutely right.
Yeah. It's you know, focus on what you do well, and you'll do well at it. It's when we all try and expand to do the little bit in the periphery that we struggle.
Yeah.
So we're getting cold out, and I've got one of those setback thermostats. And you always wonder, and maybe you know, Mike, well, maybe either of you know, like, how far back should you set it to have it save energy? And then my other question is, what other things that if, you know, gas goes up, natural gas, propane, heating oil, you know, like a gas fireplace. If you put a freestanding gas fireplace in, is that more economical than just running your furnace? Because you could heat the family room with a freestanding gas fireplace and huddle in the family room and keep the rest of the house 10 degrees cooler. Pellet stoves, wood stoves, what are your thoughts on that?
There are a lot of things that we can do to conserve energy and a lot of things we can do to make the house more efficient and, you know, save money.
Really, buy a parka and turn the heat back.
Yes. Really kind of goes back to how you want to live.
Yeah,
you can set your thermostat to 62 degrees and put on a sweater and a nice pair of pants and maybe some nice wool long underwear and be comfortable in your house. It's 62 degrees. Or you can set it to 72 and walk around in T-shirts and a pair of shorts and no sandals on. So really the big question is, how do you want to live? Everything being equal, what we have discovered, and I discovered this in my own home, we bought the electric mini splits for an addition that we put on. And it has all the bells and whistles to set temperatures back. When you're sleeping, it drops down to, you know, 52 degrees. And an hour before you wake up, it comes back up. Comfort balanced with cost, it's easier to just find a moderately lower temperature instead of being 72, keep it at 68, then letting it come back. Because when it kicks back on, if it drops down to 58 degrees or, you know, overnight, you know, 60 degrees overnight, and then you want it to come back up to, you know, 70 when you wake up, the ramp-up time is just so expensive. It takes so much energy to get back to that, and then everything gets level. So it really becomes that, how do you want to live? It's same with the direct fire hot water heaters. Everybody says, oh, it saves all that money for a direct energy hot water heater. And the only reason it does is you're only calling for heat when you're using hot water. So you're not heating a tank of water all day, every day. Now, if your family's taking a ton of showers, if you have a family of six and that hot water heater never shuts off, your gas is going to be more expensive. Your electric's going to be more expensive because the factors are in how long you're not using it. That's where your savings come. And that doesn't happen. We build all these things in saying we're going to save money by doing these things, and then we don't do the things that save the money, but we spent the money on the equipment. So, you know, running your temperature back on the smart meters or the smart thermostats, you know, you run your temperature back while you're sleeping, but then it has to warm the house back up so you're comfortable when you get up. Really where your savings would be is just keep it cooler. So,
but I like doing that with a setback. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like having it cooler when I go to sleep.
Right.
And then I certainly don't, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night, you're freezing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's nice.
Yeah, and I like sleeping colder. My wife likes sleeping warmer. So there's the. I guess I'm sleeping warmer on top of the blankets because that's just the way that works.
Yeah, you lost that argument.
Yeah, I don't fight with that one.
How about wood stoves, pellet stoves?
Wood stoves and pellet stoves are a lot more economical. There's a lot of changes coming down the pike with emissions on those, and you'll see a lot of changes with wood stoves. And pellet stoves just because of the smoke that they put out. So yes, they are more energy efficient. Actually not energy efficient. You can get the fuel source a lot cheaper.
And our programming director here has given me the hook across the neck to cut it loose and have a break. So we'll be back to House Talk shortly.
Welcome back to House Talk on WHAM 1180. And Jeff, Mike, what are you guys seeing people do differently in the downturn that we've got going on in the market right now?
Well, in our seasonal changes that we've seen, we see it, and I don't know if anybody else is the way I am. You see the seasonal and you start wondering, is this a seasonal adjustment or is it a market correction? And November for me is always the most terrifying month. November is like we fall off a cliff. And then it comes back once the Christmas season's over, and you're like, my wife yells at me and says, why do you worry about this every November and December?
It is mind-boggling. I get agents going, are you slower?
Yeah.
Did it slow down for you? Like, it does every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Every year.
And then come January, you know, what we see.
Yeah.
And you probably see it like a month later, you know, or, you know, you might see it the same time we do because people are going for pre-quals, but it slows down November, December. January, we get a burst.
Yep.
It's like, yes, I can pay for my Christmas shopping.
Every year. Yep.
February, we get belted with snow.
Yep.
And it slows down again. Yep. And then it's like March. First, second week in March, it's like somebody fires off the real estate starter pistol.
And that's usually
and
as soon as the snow melts and the sun comes out.
Yeah.
Like that's
yeah.
literally, we get that 50-degree day in March, the phone doesn't stop. You know, and we are this time of year the same way. Like, we booked nothing the first 3 days of the week, and then yesterday the phone exploded. Like, you couldn't get off the phone. It's just the weirdest this time of year.
Yeah.
But what we have done to adjust to that, you know, as an inspection company, is we're offering services that are a little different, that are not home inspections, but help people prepare. We have a pre-offer consultations where we're just kind of like your like what your dad used to do back in the 1980s when you went and looked at a house. Yep. This is, you know, an older roof. It's got an air conditioner that's kind of need to be serviced. Oh, look at that. It's a great new electrical panel. We don't go in with any tools. It's literally just the naked eye. It is not a home inspection. It's not covered by home inspection law. But what we do with that is they pay us a fee, and then that fee actually is a deposit towards a home inspection once they close on a property or if they find a house that will accept an inspection. And the reason for that is to just help people feel more comfortable in that market we just came out of. We have seen those tapering back and traditional home inspections coming back online. You know, it's kind of goes back and forth there. And I think it's all dependent on the market conditions or the availability of homes. So the pre-listing consultations are huge. So if there's any agents out there that listen, here's some numbers that you'll like to hear. We've done about 140 of those. I have the exact numbers, but we won't go down that rabbit hole. About 140 to 150 of those pre-listing consultations. Of those 150-ish pre-consultations, 120 of them actually got the home. So you came in, you looked before you even made an offer. We're trying to decide, do we make an offer? So we then started sourcing those people out and making phone calls saying, hey, how did this help you as a consumer buying this home? What did it do for you? And what we were getting in unison is it made me feel comfortable offering more money.
Well, yeah, they knew they didn't have to spend a ton of money once they bought it.
So instead of offering $180 for the house, we were willing to offer $200 because we knew we had a new roof. We knew we needed to budget for this. We needed for that. And then can you come in and give me a full inspection? And we did. And all that stuff helps them. So what we're saying to buyer's agents who may be resistant to letting someone come in as a consultation, a lot of other inspectors do it too, it benefits the seller. Although you may be a little nervous about it, it will benefit your seller.
Well, just to clarify, yeah. I mean, I had a situation where one of my agents showed up with a buyer, and the buyer had brought an inspector, not you, but they were planning on doing a complete home inspection, and which is not kosher.
No.
I mean, you know, so when you've done, you know, a few for me in the last couple of years, and, you know, when you guys show up, it really is like your uncle of Fred, who's worked in construction 100 years, you know, just walking through the house. And, you know, the last one I was at, you know, they definitely found some stuff that the house was really cool. It was a beautiful day, but, you know, he got in the back going, oh, look up there in the corner of the roof.
Yeah.
And
there are things that agents wouldn't look at because they don't, it's not that they don't know how to look at it. They don't know where to look. There are things that when I get out of a car, there are places my eye naturally goes that makes me say, I need to look at the effect of that inside the house. Or I need to look at what's going on over there based on just walking up the driveway and seeing what structure I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Oh, this era house is known to have this problem. I better just kind of poke my eyes in there. And that doesn't require an inspection. That requires, you know,
just somebody that knows
somebody knows where to look. Yeah. And, you know, and then we get into our regular home inspections. And the big difference between home inspectors is their system. We're all trained the same. How you look at the system, how you look at the house, how you document this stuff, that's what separates inspectors. Because there's a joke within our industry The inspection is for the client. The report is for the report is for the inspector. The reason I have a report is when you call me 3 weeks from now or 6 weeks from now and say, hey, do you remember when this thing did that with the door? I don't remember. There's no way I could possibly remember. I have to refer back to that report to say, this is what happened on that day at that time. And that is, you know, really important is that your inspector has a system. If you've ever been at a home inspection, Jeff, and seen that guy up the stairs, down the stairs, out the back door, out the front door, you know, turn the water off, then go run the hose bib, then you feel like you're in a three-ring circus. It's just like a whirlwind around you going around because there's no organization or structure to it. And ours is a little different in the way we operate on our inspections. You know, two-person teams, you know, and the inspector is talking to the assistant who's writing the report. The inspector's sole job is to inspect and communicate. It's not to document. That's what we have somebody who documents for. Makes it a little bit smoother, a little nicer. And then we also throw it out there to people who have owned houses for 30, 40 years, 20 years. You just forget that you have problems in your house and you don't realize that they may be tied back to something else. Or you're getting ready to sell and you want to know what you should fix, what you should budget for. So we have a whole list of services that are not just home inspections. They are services that we offer to every homeowner in America. What do you need us to do? One right now that starts coming this time of year is I'm moving to Florida. What do I do to winterize my house? We don't winterize them, but we will monitor them for you. We have a electronic monitoring equipment that goes in and registers humidity so we can prevent mold growth, measures moisture, measures temperature, all of that. So, and it comes to our phone. And we've got clients that we, you know, we'll watch their house. And we have a big commercial building that we do that. And you know, if you want us to stop in once a week and walk around to keep an eye out for, oh, there's some footprints in the backyard that shouldn't be there. Maybe we need to, you know, get us a Ring camera back there to see who's walking around your garage at night. And that is a business that picks up this time of year to help us with that bell curve we were talking about earlier, that in the middle of summer, the you know, it's fast and furious. And then in December, you're like, wow, I have to close business down because there's nothing coming through the door. So we had to figure out a way to be able to inspect and soften that bell curve.
Yeah, you should do winterization, though. I think there's a big call for that.
We've thought
about
it.
Too much liability.
Yeah, that's right there is the answer. It's like we're trying to find the insurance to do it that's realistic. Because, you know, you don't get that pipe winterized and then all of a sudden it splits and somebody comes back in the spring and opens the house up and water's pouring down inside a wall. Who's responsible for that damage? And that's really what the insurance companies are afraid of.
And we've talked about that in the past, but I have that happen at least once a year where I get called and, you know, it's an estate sale. I show up and the carpet's soaked.
Yes.
And it's in the middle of winter and, you know, yeah, they kept the power on. But nobody ever checked to make sure the heat stayed on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least if you're going away to Florida for a couple weeks in the wintertime or a couple months, turn off the water at the main, flush the toilets, get the water out of the tank.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, bowls will freeze and they won't crack. Tanks will break.
Yep.
And then the water will keep running.
And then once the tank breaks, there's nowhere the ball cock doesn't go up and turn the water off. It just keeps running. Runs and runs and runs. And you'd be surprised how much water will come out of a 3/8-inch supply line on the second floor and how much damage it'll do.
Well, we're going to be back out on break. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to House Talk. What was our number here? 222-1180?
That is our phone number. 222-1180.
You think I'd remember that? It's been a little bit. We were talking about winterizing houses, and I guess I'm not going to give details. I mean, for me, I just turn the water off, flush the toilets, and I know people have put the, the RV antifreeze?
Yeah, RV antifreeze.
That's safe in the drains so the traps won't freeze and crack. But just, you know, when you get back in the springtime and turn the water on, run around the house really quick and make sure nothing's leaking. Try the faucets, make sure nothing's leaking.
Yeah, and one of the other ones I tell people when you winterize, the hose bib outside, the hose faucet outside, even if it's frost-free and you've shut the water off of the house, open that because there's always a short section of water that gets trapped around that penetration point. Frost-free valves say it shouldn't happen, but we see it happen every once in a while. And that way, that's usually the lowest point unless you have like a laundry room in your basement or something, that's the lowest point within your house, and that's where it's going to naturally drain to. So if you get water that's residual, it's going to work its way that direction. So
yeah.
And then, like you mentioned, antifreeze in traps, toilet bowls, the back of toilets. You know, $3 a gallon, you could pick that stuff up. And it doesn't take a gallon.
Yeah, just
a couple glugs of it in there, and now the trap's not going to freeze on you over the winter.
Exactly how much is a glug?
That's a glug.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. That's a scientific measurement for all of those people out there that were wondering.
So we had talked earlier, and I had mentioned that, you know, the pet peeve. Well, I shouldn't say pet peeve because it's only happened once, but the mortgage professional that had his kid playing with his phone. You know, thinking about what other pet peeves you've got. Like, call it, for me, calling a real estate agent and the voicemail box is full. Like, you can't even, they don't answer the phone, and you can't even leave a message. And I don't know why that irritates me. I should be grateful because that's my competition.
Yeah.
What kind of things do you guys find in your profession? Like, for inspector, if I'm doing an inspection, you know, pet peeve, they bring dad.
Yep.
Or, you know, their Uncle Henry, who was a real estate agent 25 years ago for 6 months. Yep. But he's the expert.
And for us, it's the family member who, it's quite often the dad or the stepdad. I did roofs back in college, so I'm a roofer. Well, you did roofs 35 years ago, and you did it as a summer job. You're not a roofer. You installed an outlet in your kitchen. You are not an electrician. It's that guy. The guy who has dabbled on something and somehow, or is a homeowner and somehow thinks that they are now that tradesperson. Those are the ones that are the hardest because they're not user-friendly. They're trying to show that they know something. The dads usually are pretty good. And I love our female inspector, Terry. She gets it pretty heavy from the dads sometimes. And what she does, she waits for them to say something that she knows is wrong. And she doesn't aha get them, but she points out what is correct. And after two or three of those guys just kind of fade away. They just are no longer over your shoulder looking for everything that's wrong because you now have established credibility. But the true pet peeve for me is when the people show up with the hoard. It's the mom, the dad, the three kids, Uncle Joe, the dog, the parakeet, and because they never come in calm. They're muddy shoes across the carpet. They're on beds. They're open and closing doors. That is the pet peeve for me because they distract you from your job. And then the one who you tell them how our system works, what we're going to do. Can you come tell me what's going on with this in the basement and you're currently outside of the house? Like, when we get to the basement, we will look at the basement. That's the true pet peeve when they constantly are pulling you to look at something because you try and be customer service friendly, but in your head you're like, knock it off. Knock it off. Let me focus. That's my pet peeve.
Poor communication is just like, it sends me into orbit. You know, you call people, they don't answer. They won't return text. They don't call back. And I mean, these aren't just like ex-friends from, you know, old friends from college. I mean, this is people that you're trying to do a transaction with.
Oh, I love the voicemail when you call and it's full or it says, for faster response, please text. And then you text and you get no response. I'm like, well, how is that faster? Like, I understand that you're going with this technology versus that technology, but if you say that's how you're going to respond, then do that. Or they say text and then you get a phone call back or an email back. You're like, what are you doing here, folks? What about in the mortgage world? What is the pet peeve?
Similar to yours, a family member or a friend of the borrower that had bought and gotten a mortgage 20, 30 years ago and think that things are still the same now and that they know, you know, what the right program is and what the rate should be and how much money they should be spending because that's what they did back in the 90s, 80s and 90s. And it's different now. So it's educating those people, and it's even more of a pet peeve when they're not involved in the transaction directly, but you still have to convince them because then your borrower, they're going to go with what they're saying. So yeah, you've got to convince the whole family or educate the whole family and just so you can keep your borrower. So that and rate shopping, which
I understand why people do it, but it's especially kind of like irking when you've worked with somebody for so many months and gotten them pre-approved and helped them build credit. And
oh, I was able to save a quarter percent.
Yeah, ABC Bank. Then they get under contract, and you know, we're halfway through the process, and they're like, oh, you know, I've been shopping around, like, ugh. So, but I get it. I mean, I understand the rates are a big conversation with people.
Is there a big swing from bank to bank, broker to broker in rates? I mean, you're looking at like 0.25%.
Not really. Yeah.
It's not like somebody's, you know, you're telling someone 8% and they found one for 5.
Right. It's, right.
You know, I got 7.75 off that guy and I'm getting 8 from you.
Right. Right. And a lot of the times the numbers that they're receiving, they're not diving really deep with the client either and saying, oh, this, by the way, you're getting this rate, but you're paying 5 points or something, you know, they're not explaining everything. They're just making it sound nice and pretty, and it's really not.
What always warms my heart is when you're working with a buyer, you've shown them 20 homes, you have lost 2 offers, they've already been pre-qualified, they finally get a house, they show up, meet with Jamie, and it's like, well, where did this auto loan come from? Oh, I co-signed for my sister because she didn't qualify. And it's like, didn't we pretty much? I mean, I have a series of letters where I'm telling people, don't open up a Sears credit card. Don't do this, even though you're going to get a free umbrella. Don't do it. You know, everything you do, it's like, will be used against you.
Right, right. And we actually have people sign something at the time of application that goes through all the things you shouldn't do, or at least discuss with your mortgage professional before you do them. So they sign it, we go over it with them, they're aware that these things are no-nos. So when it happens, it's extra frustrating.
I've had it where people have been pre-approved, out there looking, and then they find a house. Their bank account shows nothing. Oh, you know, I'm going to get mattress money from my parents. Mm. And it's like, you got to have a trail rack. You got to have a, you know, paper trail of where the money came from.
Yep.
I would think unless you're getting the entire house covered from the mattress money, you're going to have to borrow something and you got to have some kind of trail. And it's, you know, people who, especially 1099 employees, you see that a lot where they, oh, I made $100,000 last year, but they filed for 50 on their taxes. Well, what is it? You know, well, you guys as a mortgage are going to go to what the tax records say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What your bank statements say, not, you know, where did this, you know, extra 50 grand that you're saying you made came from?
We're self-employed people. Mm-hmm. You know, they rationalize. I mean, we're all self-employed.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody, you know, a contractor, you know, and he's like, well, I make a lot more than what I pay taxes on. You know, it's like, you're not going to buy a lot more.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of this week's segment. Great seeing you guys, and we'll see everybody. I'm Jeff Schofield with RE/MAX Plus, 600-5333.
Mike Reed, All County Inspection Services, 585-773-4001.
Jamie Messner, Premium Mortgage, 585-944-8876.